Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, May 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Long a topic of derision in the media, academic, government circles. UFOs, or UAPs as they're now officially called, have lost a little of that stigma that has dogged them since the 40s, and more real science is being done on UFOs than ever before. Our guest today is at the forefront of that science. Dr. Kevin Knuth is a professor of physics at UAlbany. He's a former NASA research scientist who has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications. He's spoken in 18 countries. He can be seen on the Netflix series Encounters and in National Geographic's UFOs Investigating the Unknown. You want to talk UFOs? Now's your chance. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Kevin Knuth, UFOs and You, coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Kevin Knuth. Kevin is a professor of physics at UAlbany and the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. He is a former NASA research scientist, having worked at NASA Ames Research Center in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. His current research interests include the foundations of physics, quantum information, autonomous robotics, the search for and characterization of extrasolar planets, and unidentified aerial phenomena. Dr. Knuth has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to give over 100 presentations in 18 countries. It can be seen in Netflix Encounters and in National Geographic's UFOs Investigating the Unknown. Always great to have him on this program. In fact, he'll be here tomorrow for the Science Forum, too. But today, we have a specific topic. The number to call if you have a UFO/UAP question for Dr. Knuth is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email the show as we go along at voxpop@wamc.org. Kevin Knuth, welcome back. How are you, man?
Very good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you know, let's begin at the end. What are we dealing with here?
With the whole UAP
topic?
In
your estimation, based on your research, bearing in mind this is not a fair question, because if you say, what are UFOs, there are 18,000 different things. But are we dealing with, in your estimation, something that is not created on Earth?
I think that's certainly a possibility. It's one of the possibilities on the table, and I think it's an important one to keep in mind. These objects have been observed throughout history. There are Roman reports of flying shields, and Richard Doland, a UFO researcher, just this year published a book on called The History of UFOs.
Which is on my nightstand.
USOs, yeah. Unidentified Submerged Objects. And that's interesting because these are well-documented ship sightings, and ship captains keep logs, right? So these logs of these sightings go back into into the 1800s.
I mean, Columbus has that alleged sighting from...
Oh, there's the lights that he saw, and they were still hundreds of miles from the coast.
Could be St. Elmo's fire. I mean, there's so many explanations. When you do, and you've done, you went out the last time you were on the show, which was 4 or 5 years ago now, I think, you had gone out or were about to go out to the West Coast to investigate some of these USOs,
right,
and UAP that the Navy had allegedly sighted and interacted with to some extent, and you went out there to do science. How can you do science on something that is on the face of it so ephemeral as UFOs or UAP, whatever you want to call them?
It's difficult to study things that aren't common and are transient, right?
Yeah.
And there are many things in science that we study that are like this. You know, you study supernovas. Supernovas are not common, but they happen. And
yeah.
How do you do it? You watch the sky. You just watch the sky and wait for one to happen. So astronomers just are constantly monitoring. Studying earthquakes the same way. You have to wait for an earthquake to happen. And you put seismometers up all over the place and you wait for one. And it's the same trick with UFOs or UAPs.
So what are we doing now? When I was a kid in the 70s, Oh, I built the UFO detector, and it was basically just detecting magnetic field fluctuations and...
Which isn't a bad start, actually.
Well, didn't catch much, I'll tell you that.
Right.
But how do you do it? What sort of instrumentation are you doing? I know you have a new paper that you've been working on.
Right, right.
And we'll talk about that in a moment. By the way, the number is 800-348-2551. Kevin and I will shoot the breeze a little bit, and then we'll get to your calls. So, what instrumentation are we using?
Right, so we have... We're looking to detect many different aspects of this phenomena. So we want to catch imagery. So we have cameras. We have DSLR cameras.
DSLR being?
Like digital, high-quality digital cameras.
Invisible light, infrared, what are we talking?
Just visible light.
Okay.
Visible light cameras. And some of them are set up to just constantly take pictures, long-term exposure, so you can get tracks of objects moving. We use infrared cameras, so we have FLIR cameras, which are forward-looking infrared cameras, the same types that are on the military fighter jets.
And so you use those out on the West Coast. I know I saw
some. We use
something.
Those on the West Coast, and I have two of them in my possession that I'm still using around here, so yeah.
You know, there are more and more things in the sky that are prosaic. I mean, right. We saw and there is more and more... not maybe necessarily more and more than the 50s, but there is a level of, I don't want to say mass hysteria, but excitement. And there can be misidentifications of things. Look at New Jersey,
right.
The drones. I don't know what was up there, but I assume it was drones.
That was a mess. That was a real mess because that activity all pretty much started near the end of October, early November. And was happening in 17 countries. It wasn't just New Jersey, and that's what makes it interesting.
We didn't hear about that over here often.
Most people focused on New Jersey because it's highly populated and everybody gets excited.
Yeah.
But they were seeing them on the West Coast, off the coast of Oregon, off the coast of Washington. They were seeing them in Germany and in England, literally all over the world.
So, I mean, still, even if they're in 17 countries, you could say, well, one of our adversaries or someone on the world stage has advanced technology and these drones are just checking out military installations through. I heard about the sightings
in
England.
And that is a possibility. That's one of the hypotheses on the table, right? And that's one that we should be interested in, you know, that our governments certainly should be interested in. That's something that you would expect would end up classified, right, if they got information on that.
Yeah. Are you afraid that in the course of your investigations, and you're a science guy, man, you know, you're not a – and I'm not putting anybody down because there are a lot of lay people who have been looking into this for 60, 70 years, and there are a lot of smart people who are not scientists. But you're a scientist. Have you ever run afoul of someone who said, hey, Kevin, you better not look at that. We got this covered.
I've not had that happen. I heard a talk from Frank Drake, who you may know from the Drake equation.
Yeah. Is he still alive?
I don't think so, but when I was at NASA in around 2003 or so, I saw a talk. He gave a talk, and he was giving a talk on SETI, and he told us that they had detected an object in Earth orbit that they couldn't identify. It was actually two lunar radii out. It was further.
Wow. So this is not the black
out,
night
way out
that
from,
talked
yeah,
about.
Way out from beyond the moon. But it was in Earth orbit. And they had been tracking it, and they were going to go public with it in 1997, like July of 1997. And they were ready for a press conference. And he got a call from the Air Force at 7 a.m. and said, cancel the press conference. We know what it is, and we want you to stop looking at it.
So interesting. And
he told us this, and which is, yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, we are active in space. We're more active in space than I think we are. And
all you got to do is look out up at the sky at satellite time, and you'll see
satellites. I remember when I was a kid, we'd go out and watch for satellites, and you'd lay there for a half hour and maybe see one, right?
Yeah.
But now you go out in 5 minutes, you can see several, perhaps, if you're lucky.
Our guest today is Dr. Kevin Knuth from UAlbany, and he is one of those people who has been as interested in this topic as I have been for 50 years or close to it, and he's somebody who did something about it, as opposed to me, yeah, where I just yap about it. The number here is 800-348-2551, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. All right, tell me about your paper.
Great. Yes, we actually have two papers.
No, you say we.
And me and my colleagues. The first, I've mentioned this one first. The first one is by the UAPX team. It was first authored by my friend and colleague, Matthew Shadagas, who's a physics professor at UAlbany with me, and Cecilia Levy, who's also a physics professor at UAlbany with me, and Ben Kugielski, who works with us. He's an engineer who works with us on UAPX. And this paper is the initial results from the first field expedition of UAPX to study unidentified anomalous phenomenon. And this paper is actually about our mission to Southern California.
Oh, okay. So this is now going back 3 or 4 years, and now you have distilled this into
a paper.
So now
we've written out what we did, what our equipment was, what we learned from doing this, what we actually saw, and our analysis of it. And in fact, the movie A Terror in the Sky is a documentary that covers this mission and actually has us in it and actually doing that work.
Were you uncomfortable on camera? Were you all right with that?
A little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because, well, we're trying to get work done. We're trying to get work done.
Did they say, Kevin, that didn't work? Give me take three of this where you're looking at the FLIR camera.
There were times when they had us just looking at equipment, but we're trying to actually do work, and it was sometimes annoying.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know,
so what do you think you came up with? Anything tangible?
You know, if you watch the movie, here's a bit of a spoiler. What you'll see in the movie is you'll see a lot of excitement, and it's real excitement about us actually going out to try to collect data on these objects.
Yeah,
and so that's all totally realistic. And at one point we see the team on Catalina Island sees a bright light that they see moving. It's not, you know, it's not an airplane, and so they alert us, and we're trying to chase that down as well. And we later figured out, Matthew Shadagas figured this out, actually, that it was the International Space Station.
Oh, and so bright at times.
It was very bright. And then it just disappears, right? Magically disappears. Yeah. And everybody was, like, freaked out by this. But we were, and this is a silly mistake, and we talk about the mistakes in the paper. I mean, this is one of the reasons why you write up this paper.
It's not a mistake, though, right? This is how science is done, right?
This is how science is done. And when you do something that could be done better, you write it up and describe it. So we were using a phone app, to identify satellites, and that phone app didn't take into account daylight savings time, so it was off by an hour. So we didn't realize it was the space station, right? It was just, when Matthew realized this, he told me I was just facepalm, right? Because you realize, oh, that was stupid. And then Matthew goes and does the right thing as a scientist. He does the calculations. He takes the imagery that we captured of the object, measures the number of pixels, and then does the calculation. If it's really the space station, it's up this high, it's this big, so how many pixels should it be? And he, from the number of pixels at that altitude, calculates how big the space station should be. And he comes up with, 111 feet or something, and that's how big the space station
is. That's amazing. All right, we have to take a break here in a minute. For people like me who are, I'm out every night when it's clear and I'm looking. As a non-scientist, if it's traveling in a straight line, I usually discount it. That's just my simple sort of Occam's razor way to do it.
If satellites will just cruise along at a straight line, at a constant rate, and they can fade in and out. They can fade in and out because of clouds,
bright.
Or they can flash if they're rotating and reflecting light, or they can just disappear if they enter the terminator where you have going from the day side of the Earth to the night side.
Here's the problem. You and I could now talk for 7 hours on that. We need a podcast. There are a lot of people who want to talk to you. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Dr. Kevin Knuth is here. Your UAP calls are coming up. Unchain My Heart, John Scofield, from that Ray Charles cover album he did some years ago. We spoke about that the other day. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's UFOs, UAPs today. Dr. Kevin Knuth from UAlbany, who'll be also on the show tomorrow on the Science Forum. All right, very quickly, we got to get to the calls, but give me a couple minutes on the second paper that you did.
Right, yeah. So this is actually a pair of papers. Each on slightly different topics. They're accepted to the same journal, to a peer-reviewed academic journal, Progress in Aerospace Sciences, which is a really nice
And so when it's peer reviewed, people say, "Well, wait a minute. Here's what
peer reviewed means that other academics, you know, scientists and engineers have to read and comment on the paper and suggest edits and then accept the paper for publication.
So it has to be basically approved before.
It has to be approved.
Okay, yeah. I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, so the second paper actually came out of the first one. The editor was interested in our first paper about our mission to Catalina and wanted us to write a paragraph or two on the history of the scientific study of UAPs. And so so Matthew asked me if I would work on this, and so I started writing and found within a very short time I had 10 pages instead of two paragraphs, and I thought, this isn't going
to
work. There's
going
just
back
way
to,
too much here.
To Hynek or to McDonald?
Eventually we went back. The paper actually starts in the 1930s with UFOs seen over Scandinavia.
The ghost rockets.
The ghost rockets and these things. And I thought that was an important place to start. And so I said to Matthew, I can't do this in two paragraphs. And it doesn't really fit into our paper anyway. So we suggested, what if we were to write a second paper? And the editor liked that idea. He said, well, that would be great, and then I can create a whole special issue on UAPs, which is what he wants to do.
Okay. Oh, I got to get a copy of that.
So that's how this second paper started. And I got writing more and more and got in way over my head, realizing I don't know anything about the history of the French studying UFOs, so I had to contact some of my colleagues in France, you know, Jacques Vallée and Baptiste Friscourt and Luc Denis. I contacted these people and I said, can you guys help me out? Would you like to be co-authors on this paper and help me out with the French? And they actually helped me with the French and the Russians and the Chinese, which was really great.
Yeah.
So this paper now exploded into, it has 30 authors. It's called The New Science of Unidentified Aerospace Undersea Phenomena. And it is 194 pages long.
So it's got to be a book. You got to publish this after the fact, right?
And I don't know if I can because it's going into a peer-reviewed journal, but it basically is a book, and it's downloadable for free on the internet. So it's on the Physics Archive. So,
very cool.
So it's 194 pages long and has 499 references. So all the people who said, well, this has never been seriously studied, there's not much known, nothing's ever been published, they're totally wrong. And now this is a tome that basically describes that.
All right, we're going to go to the phones in just one second here. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. Here's the problem that I see. And again, I've been reading all of this, the more serious and the more crazy stuff, for over 50 years. The problem to me is you got wheat. You have a heck of a lot of chaff and a lot of, you know, I came from Venus. I flew around the world three times in a flying saucer. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. But it certainly muddies the waters for scientific research, right?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, we call that a very low signal-to-noise ratio.
Well, let's go to the phones and hope we have a good, strong signal here. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. Dave is in Albany. Dave, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling about 40 years ago, I was one of the people who saw the Mid-Hudson Valley UFOs, but my sighting was of something rather different. My late father was a SUNY professor like yourself, and I saw something over the Mid-Hudson Bridge one night, and it was reported about 1,500 people, police, doctors, nurses, et cetera, saw this, and this was about 100 feet over the top of the bridge, and it extended from one side of the bridge about two-thirds of the way across. I couldn't see a metallic craft from it, but it was outlined with thousands and thousands of lights and dozens of them, orbs about maybe 2 feet in diameter, glowing orange, were separated from it and were flying around. Now, some of them were as close as 15 feet from us as we went across the bridge. And it was just a very, very strange thing.
Wow. That's
wow.
a good
yeah,
one.
You can't see my facial reactions.
Yeah, that's
my mouth
one.
Is agape. That, wow, I'm envious. That is amazing. Oh, that's fantastic.
How many people were with you, Dave? At the, you know, I know you said many saw it, but how many were with you?
My friend Brian, who had been an architecture student at Penn State, and I had previously attended Vassar and Poughkeepsie and a couple years prior to that. It was a very, very strange thing. I've met a lot of people from the area who've seen that. Most people saw the Chevron boomerang-shaped thing, and I had a second sighting where I saw that from far away. But this was very, very different. This may be akin to the sighting over Indian Point, where somebody the guards there claimed to have seen something about 900 feet in length. I called the Bridge Authority. The Bridge Authority... This thing stretched from the western side of the bridge two-thirds of the way across, and it's a very evenly segmented suspension bridge, so it's like holding a ruler up to it. And my best guess is that this thing was 2,000 feet in length because it was just over the top of the bridge. My most conservative guess was that this was 1,500 feet in length. I did publish this once anonymously on the Internet about 15 years ago, and it was actually a popular I think it was the eighth most popular site if you punched in Hudson Valley UFO on Google. But since then, it's been buried. So, but, you know, 40 years since then, I haven't seen anything.
I hear you, man. All right, Kevin, you want to follow up at all?
Oh, wow. I don't know what to say. I'm astonished. I would love to see something like that. And it amazes me when I hear these stories, because these objects are huge. And I don't know how you hold one of these things up in the air and move it around at the speeds we see them moving.
Which is often very slowly.
Sometimes very slowly, yeah. And then you have hundreds of people seeing it, and then you still have people saying, oh, it's probably nothing. Well, no, it's probably not nothing.
Amazing. Dave, thanks for the call.
Amazing.
Here's my question for you. As a scientist, this Dave's story sounds like he means it.
Yeah.
What science can you do now, 40 plus years later?
Well, you can't really do much science with anecdotes like that.
Yeah,
and that's difficult. What you can do is you can collect those anecdotes, look for patterns, and try to glean some information about what hypotheses you could come up with that you could later test with some data. That's useful.
Is AI? Are you using that? I know Valet had a huge database that Bigelow kept. I don't know where it is now, but allegedly he was going to, and Valet is a computer sort of genius, was going to use AI to find these patterns.
Yeah, you can use AI to find patterns, and that's useful. And in fact, the John Mack Institute, they have all the records that John Mack had from experiencers, people who claim to have been in close contact with these objects. And they're now currently digitizing all of these and anonymizing all of this data at Rice University, and with the plans to eventually put it online. But they're digitizing it and then planning to use AI to look for patterns.
Do you think Whitley Strieber helped or hurt? In other words, he came out with that book, Communion. Everybody saw the cover in 1987 and things exploded. But was that a detriment to actually looking into the kernel of truth that we're dealing with here?
I don't think so. I mean, at some point, people needed to be made aware that this is happening. This is a human experience. I mean, people experience these things, and what they're experiencing, maybe we don't completely understand it, but it does happen to people, and that's important to know.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Vincent writes in, do you think that there have been any real and actual reverse technology initiatives over the years related to UAPs?
I have no idea. I've heard lots of rumors from a good number of people, and I'm not sure what to believe. I don't necessarily trust a lot of information that comes out from government insiders without evidence. I mean, I'm a scientist, and I am skeptical about everything, and I want to see evidence before I really believe things. So without the evidence, it's hard to know.
That rumor goes back. I mean, Len Stringfield in the 70s was writing stories from the 50s. And then, what's his name, Robert Lazar,
right,
in the 80s. How can you prove it? I mean, that's the problem with a lot of this stuff. Yeah. You can't prove it.
You probably will never prove it.
Yeah.
I think it's going to – and this is one reason why we're – we, when I say we, I mean collectively the scientists who are now trying to study this are trying to collect our own data. We're trying to collect our own data, study it openly, share data, share equipment designs and techniques and locations, and try to duplicate each other's results. We're trying to get to the bottom of this, as scientists typically do.
Will you call me if you get to the bottom of it?
Yeah.
All right. Kevin Knuth is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Steve in Latham. Steve, you're on.
I saw a video an hour ago shown to me by someone in Whitehall. His husband took it two Mondays ago. He was facing eastward, and it was clearly a rocket launch, but not a hobbyist rocket launch. It was a large white plume.
In Whitehall, New York?
All the way above the cloud layer, which was looking to be about 3,000 or 4,000 feet. And no one seems to know why or what it, who was launching. There's no military over that area. Any ideas?
That's a good question. I don't know. I know that when SpaceX was launching rockets out of, I guess it would have been Florida. I mean, you were able to see them from here.
We saw one. Yeah, yeah, it was cool.
You were able to see them, the launches from here when they're way up. But if you're seeing it like as if it's nearby in Whitehall, then that's very puzzling. I don't know.
Interesting.
It's a good question.
By the way, is there any local group left? In the old days, there was NICAP, there was APRO, there were QFOS. Is there any local group now that is still sending investigators
MUFON,
out?
MUFON is active, and MUFON sends out investigators to interview people and investigate cases, yeah.
Well, Steve, maybe you ought to send that over to MUFON and see if there's a local guy who will do that and check it out. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. John is in Manchester, Connecticut. You're on with Dr. Kevin Knuth.
Hey, guys. Thanks for covering this topic. And a lot of people have a great interest in it. And I'm one of them. I witnessed something years ago and got the, it's not UFO, what is it, UAP bug back then. And Kevin, where do I find that History of Undersea Phenomena paper?
Oh, that's a book. A History of USOs is written by Richard Dolan. And I think you can buy it on Amazon.
Okay, Richard Dolan.
So it's Richard Dolan, D-O-L-A-N.
And you know who wrote a little blurb on the back, don't you? It's Dr. Knuth.
Oh, yeah, I did. It's a fantastic book, yeah, and a lot of really interesting cases.
There's another great book called The Hunt for Zero Point. I don't know if you read that
one. I love that book.
Yes, I've read that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good physics in that. Hypothetical, but it might explain some of the technology. The thing that I witnessed was back in 94 in Pioneer Valley, Northampton, driving with a friend and saw from the highway. There was dozens, hundreds of people. Everybody basically pulled over to look at this. It was in the sky for 15 minutes to half an hour. I was stunned. Where it was a bunch of objects flashing. They were not moving. You know, wasn't meteors or anything. No explanation. Could have been a hoax, maybe, of somebody with balloons, you know, and strobes. But they all disappeared at the same time.
Wow.
And I went up to the Daily Hampshire Gazette, was up the road, tried banging on the door. It was nighttime to get the presses were running, get somebody out to look at it. But it was covered in the paper. This was June 4th or 5th, I believe, in 1994. And there was, they said there was over 350 calls to the police.
Wow.
So there is a record there of witnesses that might be able to triangulate something. But I went to the MUFON website years ago, and there was no record of it even in there. And it was on the news and everything.
Yeah, MUFON and wouldn't have it if nobody reported it to MUFON. So reporting it to somewhere like MUFON it can be helpful, because especially if there's multiple people who've seen it, it can help.
So even all these years later, I should go and let them know.
Yeah, it's only 30 years. You give it a shot.
For me, it was a huge event. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It sticks with people. John, thanks a lot. These events stick with people.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you say it, and then over the years, it's silent. You say it to a dark void, and no one can know what to do with it.
Right.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've seen a couple of odd things. I don't think it was guys from space, but I saw some things I couldn't quite understand.
Yeah.
We called the FAA tower, and it was busy for 2 hours.
Wow.
And we called them the next day and they said, well, here's the deal. Whenever we have stuff on our radar, we're only concerned with the commercial traffic.
That's right. They have a job. Yeah. They're doing it. Yeah, I mean, I've seen things too. I watched through binoculars four F-16s basically dogfight a sphere. And I thought it was an exercise. I thought it was a weather balloon. But years later, talking to pilots, told me there's no way they would conduct an exercise like that over a city. And there's no way they'd ever fly that close to a weather balloon. You'd suck it into the air and take the F-16 and bring the plane down.
So interesting.
But I watched it through binoculars. Very clear. The sphere was about one-third the length of an F-16. So,
I mean, what do you make of it? I mean, I saw the Westchester Wing right here over Albany.
Wow.
And it was an eight-minute sighting. We timed it. We got out of the car. We listened. It was a low hum. And then they were just red blinking lights with a couple white lights, huge in the front. And I said, okay, this could be a refueling operation. But then I thought, wait, you're going to refuel directly over Albany? I guess it could happen.
Yeah, strange.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. 800-348-2551. That's the number. And we'll be back. Yeah, buddy, that guy can play. John Harrington on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest. Every time we do a UFO show, and it's been 4 or 5 years since we've done one, I always say we got to do more of these because the lines are loaded. Chris in Schenectady writes, what are the funding opportunities for your research? If all internally funded, are there any indications that external funding opportunities will increase in the future?
Funding is a mess. There are no federal opportunities. There are barely federal opportunities for doing real science anymore. I shouldn't say real science, but other science. Everything's getting slashed. So
yeah.
You can't really look to the federal government right now, certainly. It's mostly been anything that's been funded has been funded by private individuals. And we at UAPX or UAlbany have not been fortunate to have that. So,
you know, very quickly, and we're going to go right back to the phones. Just in 1 minute, you went out to the West Coast. Your paper, the first paper there, is derived from the science that you did there. We're talking about Richard Dolan's book on USOs, which I have not even picked up yet. This has been discussed since at least the 60s, late 60s anyway, and Ivan Sanderson. Did you see any indication when you were out on that West Coast that, okay, some of these rumored activities underwater are going on?
We didn't get any information about underwater activities.
No, you saw nothing that even raised your eyebrow.
Not underwater. No, I did learn from. I am in contact with a New Zealand former Navy officer who was a sonar operator on the HMNZS Southland frigate, and in 1986 they were doing exercises where they were basically leaving Auckland, going up through the Hauraki Gulf, out into the Pacific Ocean, and then coming back, and then watching with sonar to see if they're followed. Mm. And they were recording if they were being followed by things that they couldn't identify as submarines. So they were followed by objects that didn't have propeller wash. Mm. And at one point, they were followed by a large – this went on for months. And it's all classified, right?
Right.
We tried to get documents, and it's classified.
Yeah.
So they were followed then by a large object that they measured to be 150 feet wide and followed them well into the Gulf. And they were concerned about this, so they tried to lose it. And they were moving, I think, close to 45 miles an hour, which is fast for a frigate, and did a very steep turn where the – basically, the ship is like 45 degrees angles. You know, he was saying men are falling out of their bunks, right? And he goes, but when they did that, they were able to measure its length, and it was 800 feet long. And the largest submarines are the Soviet Typhoon class, which are about 600 feet long. He said, so this thing was bigger than a Typhoon class submarine. And then it closed the distance. It closed that distance, which was, I think it was 25 kilometers in 25 seconds.
Wow. Okay.
And went under their ship, and when it passed under the ship, they lost all their power, and they went adrift.
Yikes.
And I have the sonar data from that.
You do?
I do.
I thought you said it was classified. How'd you get that?
He had it when they had the encounter. He was running the printer, and that printer is printing out the raw sonar data, and it stops the moment that it went under the ship because they lost power. And then he ripped the paper up and shoved it in his pants.
Okay, so he pulled a Sandy Berger. But here's the thing, man. Okay, so this to me, if I was skeptical, I'd say, well, that's a pretty implausible story. And we see cases, and sometimes even recently, where somebody famous might have a – oh, I got pictures here. I got this thing. Look at this. Somebody who is – has credentials.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's discredited by something like that,
right,
where you don't exactly, you're not sure. You have to go by guy's word. Okay, right. I ripped this off the printer and put it in my pants.
Yeah.
But if it's real, it's huge. But is it an attempt to discredit? I mean, this is my question.
And this is so this could be a worry, you know. So doing the initial calculations from his description, that thing would have been going at top speed something like 3,000 miles an hour underwater.
That's a pretty crazy good clip, yeah.
And it is the raw sonar data. So I'll be honest, I don't know how to analyze sonar data. I met with just a couple of weeks ago. I was in Houston and I had lunch with Admiral Tim Gallaudet, and I showed him the sonar data and was asking him, what does this all mean? How do you interpret this? And so he was trying to help me with this. So we'll see.
What did he think? He would be in a position to know such things.
Yeah, well, it wasn't sonar data that he was accustomed to looking at either, because he's an oceanographer. So they're using sonar for different purposes, right? So it's difficult.
Dr. Kevin Knuth is our guest today. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. And let's see. Oh, gosh. Christopher in Monroe has been waiting half an hour. Christopher, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Ray and Dr. Knuth, for accepting my call. Listen, this just ties together. Can you explain what you think the technology for Puma Puku, Sacsayhuaman, and Baalbek, Lebanon? We can't do nothing like that. So
I don't even know.
Is it possible that it had to have something to do it?
Well, thank you for your call, Christopher. I'm not familiar with those. Can you describe what they are? What
briefly,
Puma Puku is?
Tell us what that is. What's Puma Puku?
That's what I'm telling you, Ray. You need to check that out.
All right,
have
man.
Your listeners look
All right.
at it.
I'm taking notes.
He's writing it down. Can you spell it, Christopher?
P U.
Yep.
M A.
Yep.
P U K A. Puma Puku.
I will check it out. Thank you very much. And, next time you're on, we'll have to do a follow-up on that.
Let's see. I'll look into that. Thank
you. We'll go to George in Swanton, Vermont. George, you're on with Dr. Kevin Knuth.
Hey, good afternoon. I was just wondering, how many people, I know it's kind of like not something people talk about a lot because they get laughed at and they ask if you're on drugs or whatever, but how many people have actually seen multiple UFOs throughout their lifetime, starting at a young age when they weren't susceptible to any manipulation and, like, actually with their parent at the time, and then, like, at an older age with the other parent, two different kinds of UFOs, and then seeing two other ones beyond that, in between? How many people have actually seen a couple of UFOs throughout their life, like, credible?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure if anyone really does. I don't know. I've never heard that question asked. So I'm actually, if it's all right with you, I'd like to make a note of that question.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's an interesting thought.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, because a couple of times, like, people will ask me, like, oh, have you seen a UFO? And it's like, oh, yeah, actually, I've seen, a couple. And I tell them, too, right off the bat. And, like, right off the bat, they'll laugh or this, that. And it's like, well, no, actually, it happened when I was a kid. And it was, like, right there. It was like a Ford Oval at the end of a cornfield, a big silver Ford Oval just hovering over the tree line. And me and my father pulled over, and we were there for, like, 5 minutes looking at it. And I was, like, 5 or 7 years old. And I was just, like, kind of like, what is that? I never seen that before.
And it stays with you, doesn't it?
That's really cool. That's really amazing.
Hey, George.
Yeah, it's like heavy. Like when you think about it, it's like, wow, man, I actually saw something that, like, it's unexplainable, totally unexplainable, just sitting there.
George, thank you very much for the call. I mean, there have been not scientific studies, but of people who have throughout their generation, throughout their lives, when they're kids, later in life, they have their experiencers of some kind. I don't know. Again, I don't know what you can get from these other than compiling them into huge databases, which they've been trying to do for 70 years now. Let's go to Tom in Malta. Tom, you're on with Dr. Kevin Knuth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was fortunate enough when I was 9 years old back in 60-something, and I was able to see the Kecksburg UFO fly over Pontiac, Michigan.
Wow.
And,
Interesting.
Yeah, that was what I said when it flew over.
What was your first impression when it went over? Obviously, Kecksburg didn't hit our consciousness till well after that day. But what did you think?
Well, it was me, my brother, and my best friend were playing football in the playground across the street from our home, and it was just, I don't remember hearing it coming in. But when it passed over top, it was just like, holy mackerel. And then ran home.
Did it make a sound? Was there a sonic boom or anything like this?
I don't recall a sonic boom because I used to hear those back when they used to do supersonic flights over residential areas. But I don't recall that. But I just vaguely recall a whooshing sound. And again, it was only maybe for a second that I was able to see it.
Right.
But I imagined it was like flaming or fiery red. And and then from there, then it was tell my mom. She called somebody or pretended to call somebody. And then after that, then it showed up in the newspapers and stuff after that. And then, but that was... That was something. Actually, I called a few years ago and talked to you when you had your astrologists on there.
Astronomers.
And you said, astronomers, yeah,
right.
The astronomers on there. And you said, and they said, what are you talking about? Because they were too young.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And you said to call back a couple of months. And
you didn't get through.
The individual that I think right now.
Yep.
But I called in too late.
Oh, I'm sorry,
and
man.
Didn't get on.
The Kecksburg UFO sighting is so interesting. There are varying reports. Some reports say this thing turned. This went in different directions. Kevin, have you ever looked into the trajectory of this thing in 1965?
No, I haven't at all. I at one point saw some documents about the Kecksburg event, and I saw that my dad's cousin, who was Donald Hornig, he was the scientific advisor to President Johnson, well, Kennedy and Johnson both, and he was actually noted as being present during some of the meetings, which I thought was interesting. He designed the electronic switches on the first atomic bombs in the Manhattan Project.
Wow,
and in Oppenheimer, they didn't actually have he. Oppenheimer had him sit in the tower the night before with the bomb during the thunderstorm.
Oh.
He guarded it with a sidearm.
Very nice.
Yeah, and that was my dad's cousin. Now, his wife was actually in the movie Oppenheimer. His wife was Lily Hornig was his wife, a chemist. She was the chemist from Harvard who was featured in the movie a bit. But,
wow. Yeah. All right, well, Tom, thanks a lot for that one. I find the Kecksburg thing interesting. To me, it seems like, okay, and hearing about your uncle being involved, to me, it sounds like, okay, a Russian sat crashed. It was acorn-shaped or whatever.
Yeah, it could be a satellite. It's a tough one, right?
Or a capsule from a space launch. All right, let's go to Jeff in Western Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on with Dr. Kevin Knuth.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Doctor.
Hello.
Back in the mid-70s, my wife and I were at a federal flood control dam in foothills of the Berkshires, and it was nighttime, and we saw this cylinder-shaped object with lights going across the top of the dam, and then all of a sudden it was gone. Well, it freaked us out enough where I had a Volkswagen at the time, and we jumped in the car, and the car wouldn't start. We had to pop start the car, and when we looked behind us, the thing was right over the reservoir, like 2 feet off the water. And as soon as I turned my lights on to hightail it out of there, the thing just came right over our head and followed us up the hill, and it just freaked us both out, and we still talk about it to this day.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, bang, it's gone.
And so you had to, you push started your Volkswagen? Is that how you got it started, or?
Yeah, yeah, the car wouldn't start. But wow. what was even weirder was last year or 2 years ago, we're watching Netflix on Unsolved Mysteries, and it was about the same time of the Barrington abduction up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And we're only like 20 miles away from there.
Wow.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, the cars not starting is really an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
That happens with gasoline engines, not diesel engines. So
interesting.
It's because it's thought that the UFOs are creating very high electric fields that are basically ionizing the air and shorting out the spark plugs.
Do you believe that, or is?
Yeah, I do. I do. And actually, when I watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you've got Richard Dreyfuss's, you know, truck stalls out, right? And it stops running. And then when the UFO leaves, it starts again. And I always thought that was silly until I learned that that actually happens in about 10% of the cases. And it turns out that it wouldn't have happened in the case in the movie. Of course, here we have a physicist ruining the science in a movie again. But it wouldn't have happened in the movie because Dreyfuss was driving a Ford F-150. That's a diesel engine.
Wow.
So they don't actually shut down.
Did you ever let Spielberg know?
No, I'll tell him someday.
Yeah.
I don't want to ruin the movie. It's a great film. Otherwise, everything else is dead on. But
yeah.
But they do restart. And they restart because the electric field is also shorting out the distributor switch. And so you've got current flowing through the primary of the ignition coil. And so when the UFO leaves, that opens again, and then it sends a pulse to the secondary and triggers a spark plug.
Right.
So 10% of the time they'll restart.
You know what? Now I know you're a science geek. I'll tell you that. So listen, we only have 15, 20 seconds here. Bill in Poughkeepsie, we don't have time for his call. What are your sentiments on the official records being released by the U.S. government right now? We only have 15 seconds.
It's tough. I've often said, you know, even if, you know, I said this when Biden was president, but it's true with whoever is president. Even if the president comes out and, you know, says that these are aliens visiting Earth, I want to see evidence. I'm not going to believe it until I see evidence. So official records, they need to have evidence. I mean, the Pentagon, you know, blamed Roswell on Project Mogul. But we know it can't be Project Mogul because there wasn't a balloon in the air, because we have the records from the physicist who ran the project from NYU.
They didn't blame the Project Mogul until the 90s. It was a long time.
Yeah, that's right. They blamed lots of other things. Yeah.
Hey, man, we're done now, but we got to do this again, all right?
All right, brilliant. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Kevin Knuth. Support comes from River Valley Co-op in Northampton at East Hampton, supporting local farmers and featuring local produce, dairy, meat, and cheese. RiverValley.coop. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, offering fine artist materials on custom picture framing in Rhinebeck at New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Kevin Knuth for being here. You'll hear him tomorrow on the Science Forum. No UFO calls tomorrow, though. We'll have a lot of science to do tomorrow, but we'll do this topic again. Hey, it's Listener Appreciation Week. We're sharing voices from around the region in your station, your stories. And you can keep this station going strong. These are tough times. 800-323-9262. You can make your pledge, but we will hear something as soon as Count Basie does the big finish. And thanks for listening to this one. We'll see you tomorrow for the Science Forum.